Aloha again.
Put this up a little bit.
And happy Valentine's Day. I wanted to do a Hawaiian theme for a couple reasons. One, Hawaiian culture is just a happy culture, and I like it. It's warm and the people are friendly. That's a good thing to think about on Valentine's Day when it's cold and snowy outside. I understand that for some, Valentine's Day can be a sheer horror. Some won't even say Valentine's Day, it's V-Day. Thus, a change of venue to a Polynesian theme might allow some to not be so assailed by the red and the roses and all of it. We'll move it to a place that's easy to picture, even if you've never been to Hawaii. Two, I have a ton of Hawaiian gear, and I use it any chance I get. Marty and I enjoy putting on a luau when we can. And finally, I back myself into a corner by naming my sermon Tiny Bubbles, after the famous Don Ho song. Thus, I really had no choice but to go all out. And besides, Kleber's not here, so we can haul out the decorations and have us a good time. I must confess, however, I was very surprised and disappointed yesterday. I did a memorial service for a patient who died along with a Pentecostal pastor, Pastor Ron, to be precise. We got to chit-chatting before the service, and I sheepishly told him that I was doing a Hawaiian-themed service in the morning. His eyes got very big. He seemed taken aback. Oh no, I thought, he's going to say something Pentecostally at me. He's going to really let me have it for blaspheming something. Suddenly he slapped my back. Well, the Lord sure put me in my place. Here I thought us Pentecostals were so creative. The Unitarians beat us to it. Our luau service is next week. Hawaii aside, here's how this sermon came about. As some of you may know, I'm a hospice chaplain. Those I serve have less than 6 months to live and are no longer pursuing curative measures. Now, I really love my job. It's meaning-making and spirituality on the highest level. My clients don't have the time to mess around. Their families don't have time to dance around a subject. It's straight in at it. It's anger at God. It's profound sadness and regret. It's even sometimes joyous and hilariously funny. Just this week, I spent a few hours with a family at the bedside of the family patriarch, beloved father, and grandfather to about 10 in the room. Oh, how the stories flowed. The heartache, the hard times, the good times. And then a story about the death of his beloved wife of 52 years ago. They cremated her and decided to scatter her ashes in the Grand Canyon, which actually is illegal. They arrived at the park, and they knew it. They arrived at the park just shortly before the park was to close. They had Mom's urn in a backpack. And as they approached the trail, a ranger approached the group in front of them, telling them that the park was closing soon. The grandson panicked, saying, "Dad, what are we going to tell the ranger that we're doing out here?" Dad very calmly says, "Well, we're going to tell him we're here to drop off Mom." Luckily, the ranger moved down the trail and they found a private spot right on the rim of the canyon. They soon discovered, however, that the lid of the urn was sealed shut. So they literally had to bash the lid 15 times against a rock to get it open. But they finally did it. Their father, man who was dying in the bed, went first, scooping up a handful of his spouse and scattering her into the canyon, the breeze blowing her gently away into the setting sun. It was intensely beautiful, they said, a sacred moment. At this point in their story, they all stopped, remembering that moment, looking down, breathing deeply in reverence. The son then continued the story. So I went over and scooped a handful of mom and stepped up to the edge of the canyon. And I tilted my hand and boom, the wind reversed and mom went flying all over me. God damn it, mom, cut me some slack, would you? We laughed so hard. He said there's a scene just like it in the movie The Big Lebowski, but it's not so funny when it actually happens to you. We settled back into our chairs around the bedside, listening to the cadence of ragged, slow breathing. My job requires a lot of authenticity. I have to know myself, be comfortable with myself, and most of all, be comfortable with my own mortality. My job is like any other, except that I face my own mortality every day. I tend vigil to death all the time, and it changes one. It makes me strive to be better, to love more deeply, because I see all the time what shall happen to us all, and what can happen at any age. I have a 33-year-old man on service right now. But it has to be 100% about them and their needs, their spiritual and emotional needs, and not about me and my own issues. The vast majority of my training as a chaplain has been to learn to get me out of the way. I have to be loving, a non-anxious, compassionate presence, attending to their needs, enlisting and empowering their hopes, and marshaling their resources. I go where they are and not the other way around, speaking their religious language and working with their spiritual architecture. So about a month ago, I got a request from Bob, one of my clients. I don't know why we call them clients, it's just the language we use. I think it's awfully businesslike, but that's what we have. Pastor, I get called that a lot. It used to bug me intensely, but now I realize that different people have different needs in labeling me. Again, learning to take my own issues out of the way. Pastor, I'd like you to give me communion. Sure, Bob, I'd be happy to, I said in the most sincere voice I could muster. I was worried that he would hear the uncertainty in my voice. Bob was blind, so he couldn't see my expression. I don't have the host or wine with me, so would Monday be okay? Sure. After chatting a bit longer, I left. Over the weekend, I struggled to find how I could authentically give Bob communion when I had long ago left the religious world that communion evolved from. It's my hang-up with Christianity, with communion, with the whole Jesus died for my sins things, but not Bob's. Here's a dying man's request, and I'd better find a way to give communion because there's no faking it in chaplaincy. Especially the dying can tell in an instant that you're faking it, that it isn't authentic. And at that point, the trust is lost forever. They will never let you in. They don't have the time to make up or understand my objection to Christian soteriology, the concept of salvation. So I sat down to work it through. Okay, what are the words? And Jesus took the bread, and after he blessed it, he said, "This is my body, which is broken for you. Take, eat. Do this in remembrance of me." And Jesus took the cup and said, "This is my blood, which is shed for you. Take, drink, and do this in remembrance of me." I knew these words well from my Presbyterian upbringing. Ugh. I don't know how I can do this. I have to be able to understand what is behind the ritual in my own way, so that I can authentically give to him communion. Let's think about the low-hanging fruit here. What am I going to use to do this? Well, my colleague, Chaplain Mike, told me he keeps a box of wheat thins in his car for the bread, just for such a request. They work great. You can crack them, and they make a good noise. And I can imagine the brokenness in times when I have been broken. No problem here. and for a chalice. Immediately, I thought of our chalice symbol. Ah, I could use that martini symbol one. That's nice. He's blind. It would be authentic for me. You use the flaming martini glass. Perfect. And then it came to me, and this is the total truth. That song, Tiny Bubbles in the Wine, it came into my head. And I don't know why it did. It's a goofy, silly thing. But it did. And so I had a nice little happy thought about, oh boy, this is going to be funny. I'll put on a little Don Ho and put some champagne in the glass, and we've got a communion. I mentally giggled at the thought. And I got this funny feeling. That there was something true about what I had just thought. What on earth is ringing true about tiny bubbles in my wine? Now, this is truly a moment when it's good to be Unitarian. What other religious faith could combine the metaphorical blood of Jesus and a Don Ho song and come up with something meaningful? Now, that's advanced hukilau culture. We can bring any dish we want to the event, and this communion drink was going to be a doozy. But what I began to think about is the upward movement of the bubbles. And that reminded me of my master's thesis from Meadville Lombard Theological School. I had to work this master's thesis in somehow. It was a useless 80-page document otherwise. My master's thesis was about theological anthropology, or how the divine interacts with humanity, and how much agency does humanity have? In other words, how much of a hand do we have in our own spirituality and in our own salvation? We have quite a high theological anthropology. We have the ability to think religiously about Don Ho, to find high church in potluck or the newcomers event that we had last night. To us, God, divinity, or whoever it concerns ordains that, or at least doesn't get in the way. For Calvinist Christianity, a very low theological anthropology is the only way. Humanity is one level above pond scum. Actually, it's worse than pond scum. Humanity screwed itself up. It is inherently sinful, inherently wrong. And that's quite a distance between our first principle, isn't it, of inherent worth and dignity. But here's our problem. Here's our problem. We can be, as Unitarians, too surface. Our natural uplifting nature can lead us to just skim the surface, to not deal with depth or go below into the real world of pain and suffering. We're privileged people. I'm privileged in many ways. Now, we do use our privilege for good when we can and when we think about it, but sometimes we keep real suffering at arm's length. We can be intellectually elitist, talking about theological anthropology, for instance. We can be narcissistic, all into our diversity. And yet, why, in most of our congregations, is there truly so little of it? And we can be fundamentalist with the best of them. Here I was arrogant, thinking that only we Unitarians are creative enough to have a Hawaiian service. I guess the professed fundamentalists thought of it too. And here I need to follow in Pastor Ron's example. I need to, in a way, let the Lord put me in my place, as Pastor Ron said. I'm not unique. I screw things up. I was writing this sermon until the very last minute. I sometimes don't want to deal with people's problems, and heck yeah, I'm enjoying the focus on me right now. I am somewhere, I think, in the middle of the theological anthropology scale. I could be a putz, but I can also be profound. We all have our moments like that, don't we? But I need something that allows me to move up and down that scale. When I need to be uplifted, I need a vehicle to get there. And when I need a good old-fashioned Calvinist reality gut punch, I need something to do that to me too. As I sat there thinking about it with tiny bubbles playing in the background, I remembered my solution to a high theological anthropology. Add a seventh source to our living tradition, one that comes from inside. Mary read that. They were external sources. The bit I would add would be the lifelong examination of our own pain and suffering and failings in relation to the pain, suffering, and failings of others and how we and they found redemption. Let me read that again because that's a bit thick. The lifelong examination of our own pain and suffering and failings in relation to the pain, suffering, and failings of others and how we and they found redemption. No, I don't know the pain of being a minority, but more than once I've been painfully ostracized. No, you may not know the sheer glory of playing principal horn on Strauss's Ein Heldenleben, except for Willis, who was a fellow horn player. But you've experienced many times in your life a transcendence of spirit where you came out of yourself. See, we're back on the potluck theme. It's what you bring to the potluck. I get to try it, and you get to share it. And that is what makes us incredible as a religious people. When we share the sufferings, failings, and pain of our own lives with others, we are enhanced. We transcend our bounds. When we share how we found redemption, what got us out of it, we are engaging the divine. And we aren't avoiding anything. We aren't surface. We've got depth. It's what I feel in this church every time I come. Depth, great depth. But it takes courage and it takes work to go into one's own pain and suffering and failings. Nobody likes to do that. Sometimes we need a hand, a favor. And I feel when I make myself open to it, it comes to me and it comes often. And what I'm speaking of is an old Christian term, but I'd like to kind of co-opt it for us. The term is grace. Christians often define grace as the unmerited favor of God. I don't think it's unmerited. I think we all have dignity and worth. We humans are worth it. I think you can do something to draw moments of grace or tiny bubbles to you. You could keep going back again and again to the seventh source. A wonderful colleague of mine, I deeply love her in a profound way, was waiting to hear if she had gotten a UCC pulpit from a wonderful little church. The day I saw her, she broke down sobbing in my arms. They didn't give it to me because of who I am. A lesbian with a stable partner of 14 years and two loving, sweet children. I bawled with her, and we cried and we cried. We actually sank down on the floor. I felt deeply her pain. After a long while, I took off my glasses and wiped my face, and then I chuckled. Thank God I didn't wear my contacts today. I only had one pair. I surely would have lost them that time. We laughed and laughed, and it was a moment of grace, real small, just a tiny bubble. But it was the turning point for us to get up off the floor and to start again. It's the letting mom drift into the wind, out into the sunset over the canyon. It's also the final joke of mom blowing back in your face. God damn it, mom, cut me some slack. Think back on those hard times, if you will. And think about that turning point. Was it a moment of grace? I have those. Think about those moments of grace. You know, I don't know where grace comes from. And frankly, I don't even know if it really matters. I just know it seems magical when it happens. I also think that grace happens to all people, regardless of belief, regardless of age, regardless of creed, color, class. Yesterday at the funeral of Ruby Mirror, the 17-year-old grandson said the most profound things, a 17-year-old. And you remember a few weeks ago when we had our Martin Luther King Day service, when Kleber brought the children up front, and they asked him, does anybody know who Martin Luther King was? Expecting to fill in the blank for them. And a three-year-old answered in perfect clarity who he was, what his mission was. I was stunned. And Kleber had the presence to just lay the microphone down and let that one be. That was probably one of the most intense moments of grace I've ever experienced. Wow. Our three-year-olds are getting it. That's amazing. It was a moment. That was grace. Last night, people brought and shared, bore their souls at the newcomers' gathering at the coffee hour, screwed up some, laughed it off, had a wonderful time. But it's not enough just to examine our suffering and how we got out of it. Might as well join the ethical society. And that's not a slight. But we as Unitarian Universalists here in this church, we are so blessed by the workings of grace. Some would say of the divine. Others would say the grace of our religious community. And the grace of each other's beautiful dish that we have brought to share with each other. We are a hukilau culture, a potluck culture. Take, eat, take, and drink, and do this to remember. Amen.